I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. I am back with Pox Populi. Pox, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me on again. Good to be here.
It's great to have you back. So I thought we would do two things today. In the first hour, I'd like to talk about the genealogy of wokeness. And I specifically want to talk about an article that Paul Gottfried wrote. It's over at Chronicles called Marx Was Not Woke. And then we can go more broadly into the reactions to that particular article in our sphere and just our own reactions as well. I'm thinking of writing a little something on it. The article, I'll just summarize for people, and it's linked here in the original post and also in the stuff I put on Gab and the stuff I put in Telegram. It's the last link. So take a look at it. It's an archive.md link. Basically, what he does is he starts out by talking about an argument made by Yoram Hazony in his book, Conservatism, A Rediscovery. And so immediately, I feel like I'm back in academia. I'm back in, you know, the mainstream. I'm like a little kid sitting at the table listening to two Jewish intellectuals arguing about important matters. And I have to be quiet. But I don't. I have my own platform now, so I can pipe up. But anyway, Hazony basically argues that wokeism is directly an expression of Marxism. And there are some cavils and kvetches that Paul Gottfried has about that I think are interesting. But I just want to, I'll read a few passages, okay? And just so that we both have this in our minds. Yoram Hazony provides what's perhaps the best explanation of how the woke left represents an updated form of traditional Marxism. His argument, which is ably presented in his book, Conservatism, A Rediscovery, is summed up as follows. Marx's principal insight is that the categories liberals use to construct their theory of political reality, liberty, equality, rights, and consent, are insufficient for understanding the political domain. They are insufficient because the liberal picture of the political world leaves out two phenomena that are, according to Marx, absolutely central to human political experience: the fact that people invariably form cohesive classes or groups, and the fact that these classes or groups invariably oppress or exploit one another, with the state itself functioning as an instrument of the oppressor class. And so what Hazony argues is that that's the basic template of wokeism. It's understands the world as basically a battle between different collectives, that the state is a tool of class or group oppression of one group over others, and that they slightly tweaked the understanding of who the oppressed class is and who the oppressors are. Marxism was looking at capitalists versus the proletariat, whereas today it's evil white people versus the global South, women, transsexuals, whatever. So the basic structure is the same, but the villains have changed slightly. And I think that that's essentially correct. I don't think there's anything wrong with this. And I think that Gottfried's counterarguments are really, really weak. So his first counterargument comes a few paragraphs in. He says, unfortunately, Hazony cannot escape the materialist foundation of Marx's historical theory. Marx is not in the least concerned with non-binary oppression, raging homophobia, or the inherently evil nature of being white. This father is scientific socialism focused on socioeconomic antagonisms expressing themselves as class conflict. His historical materialism, however, was overhauled in interwar Germany as the Frankfurt School and its critical theory came onto the scene. And then he goes on and basically explains how it was this next phase of Marxism, the critical theorists of the Frankfurt School, that led to basically wokeism. Okay, I'm hearing a pretty strong argument for the genealogy of wokeism right out of the mouth of Paul Gottfried here. And he doesn't want to seem to accept that, though. And I think his argument about historical materialism and stuff like that is kind of analogous to this sort of argument. And then I'm going to turn it over to Pox. Let's say we're doing the genealogy of the great Adams family. I've been reading the second president of the United States, John Adams, who is, I think, the most brilliant of the founders. Anyway, Adams was the second president of the United States. His son, John Quincy Adams, became president of the United States. His grandson, Charles Francis Adams, was, I think, a secretary of state, an ambassador. And his great-grandchildren were great writers. Okay, so this is an amazing genealogy. Now, the argument that there's no genealogical connection between Marxism and wokeism would be analogous to saying, well, yes, it is true that John Adams married Abigail Smith, and they had six children, and one of those six children was John Quincy Adams, and then he was the father of Charles Francis Adams, and he was the father of Brooks Adams, and so forth. Okay, and Henry Adams. Henry Adams, the great historian, was also part of that family. Yes, this is all true, but you know, Henry Adams wasn't married to Abigail Smith. And what's more, Henry Adams didn't wear powdered wigs like the original Adams. And you would have to look at that and you'd have to scratch your head and you'd have to say, yes, that's true, but that's completely irrelevant. And we all know in genealogy that with each generation, there are going to be some differences. We're not talking about clones leading identical lives, right? We're talking about a family that has a lot of things in common and some things that are different, but they're connected together biologically. And if you didn't have the original Adams, John Adams, you wouldn't have had Charles Francis Adams, you wouldn't have had Brooks Adams, and so forth. In the same way, you can say that the Frankfurt School would not have existed without Marx, and wokeism wouldn't have existed without Marx or the Frankfurt School. And yes, Marx probably would have been puzzled by a lot of things that he sees the woke left doing. However, I think he would be quite understanding of what it is. He would recognize the family resemblance there. And the fact that, you know, he was from a different generation and had a different kind of pseudoscientific window dressing than, say, the Frankfurt School or later the wokists, who are just outright deniers of science, I think wouldn't matter in the least. So what are your thoughts on this?
Well, I'm going to try and maintain fixed gaze, like a border collie staring at a sheep. I'm going to try and maintain a fixed perspective on what are we actually talking about here? Because the title of Gottfried's piece is Marx Was Not Woke. So I think it's useful to define, well, what is woke? I mean, it's already more or less difficult enough, especially to define what is cultural Marxism, if not Marxism itself. That's, I suppose, easier to define. But when we get into cultural Marxism, that has proven to be a tricky thing to define. Certainly someone like Jordan Peterson has had people approach him or reproach him saying, well, you know, cultural Marxism that you keep going on about, what is that? And plenty of ink has been spilled trying to define what that is. I don't think there's anything wrong in the title of Godfrey's piece saying Marx was not woke. I don't like these sort of things where you speak for the dead. You know, Eric Arthur Blair would have been Antifa. Why? Because he was a socialist and he fought with the Republicans in Spain. Tolkien would have loved the diversity of Rings of Power. You know, don't speak for the dead. I don't think, yeah, like you were saying at the end there, I don't think Karl Marx would, I don't think he'd be, you know, perhaps totally towing the line with a lot of the current fundamentals, the pillars of the ruling regime's ideology. But I don't know. Maybe he would. I don't know. It's an impossible thing to know. And then what are we talking about with woke? What is woke? You know, I really hate this word. I hate that it's become the term. I mean, it comes from Ebonics, basically. It comes from Black culture. Originally, you know, this is basically just Black vernacular and it's silly use of English language. To be woke instead of to be awake or something of that nature. To be woke was basically to, you know, be a red-pilled Black person. but as far as Black issues go. And now it's become the term used by conservatives to describe anything from, you know, Dylan Mulvaney hawking Bud Light to, you know, anti-white racism, and pretty much anything else that's basically, you know, extreme leftism. And, you know, so Marx was not woke. Even in Gottfried's article, he concedes in the first three paragraphs, he says that the other Jew, Yoram Hazony, is, quote, undoubtedly correct in his assessment of, you know, how Marxism is sort of like the fountain from which this modern wokeism has sprung. And then in the other paragraphs, he even says that Hazony is correct, that the woke left has outflanked self-described liberals in the media and the academy by defending collective identities. So I'm actually quite surprised at why this got some people's knickers in a twist. It's reminded me of the last time we spoke. I think it was the last time. With, I think Morgoth was on that one, and we talked about another sort of rift, you know, people talking about socialism versus third positionism, and is socialism okay, or is it always evil? And I just get amused. I get amused by these, I don't know, it's like arguments between diagnosticians or arguments between building inspectors about, you know, what's the problem and where did it come from? I don't know. It doesn't strike me as the most important thing, but, you know, it's an intellectual exercise, I suppose. And I saw people were saying that, you know, no, Marx would totally be a BLM supporting, rainbow flag waving, tranny supporting wokist because he's the father of all of it. Again, I'm not so sure. So I did some sleuthing on the internet. And as far as Marx's views on things like queer theory, LGBT stuff, really the only primary source is a letter that he wrote to Engels in 1869. And it was in response to something that Engels had sent him regarding this group called the Uranians, Uranians. And they were arguing about a supposed third sex. They were putting out this idea that there's a third sex. And when Marx got wind of this from Engels, he responded basically by calling them pederasts and smut merchants. And he completely, you know, like just waved them away and said they were basically just, you know, degenerates. Now, that isn't to say that Marx and Engels weren't sympathetic to the cause of blacks, black slaves in America, for example, or that they didn't throw their weight behind the Irish cause for independence from Imperial Britain, or any of the other, you know, quote unquote, oppressed communities or groups. And so even if Marx in his time said that these queer theorists, you know, these fledgling queer theorists of the 1860s were smut merchants and pederasts, well, I'm sure that he would have seen the utility in backing them as another collectivized group that can be used to thwart the capitalist oppressive machine.
Exactly. That I think is a very important point. One of the things that Gottfried says is that when in power, Marxists were actually somewhat conservative about things like feminism and the family and queer theory and things like that. Well, yeah, there's a difference between Marxists in power and Marxists trying to get in power. We do know that they play little games. And one of the things that they have done, and they've done it within the historical communist movements that actually took power in the 20th century, is they promoted these sorts of things. They promoted free love, sexual libertinism, abortion, and all kinds of things, because they thought that these would be destructive of bourgeois society. And then when they actually got in power, some of them were on autopilot. They were just sort of zombies. and they were drunk on power and drunk on destruction and just wanted to continue down this path. At a certain point, basically, Stalin said, we need to govern now, and you need to cut this childish stuff out. And he blew the whistle on it. And so to say, well, they actually governed in a somewhat conservative way, is in no way praising them. Because you have to understand the context here. You have to understand that Marxists went out of power, are perfectly content, and this was long before the 1960s, long before the current woke left. This was old school, First International communism. They promoted these kinds of movements everywhere that they wanted to overthrow society and try and take over. I think that that's simply undeniable in the historical record. And it's just bizarre that this Gottfried fellow just wants to say, well, they were actually sort of based in conservative on the homosexual question. I think that that's, it's cherry picking. And I wonder why cherry pick to defend the honor of Karl Marx. And later, basically, he's defending the honor of somebody like Joseph Stalin. That's very peculiar. Why do that? Anyway.
Well, I think it's, again, I'm reminded of that edition we had of Countercurrents Radio with Morgoth. Some people want to look towards Marxism and communism as the source of the ills of today. And there's some other people, some other groups, individuals, who have pointed at liberalism. And that second group upsets the first group because the first group does not want to believe that a Northwestern European quote-unquote ideology, for lack of a better term, native to us, you know, native to the European biosphere, liberalism, could be the problem. Much easier to point the finger at this exo-European ideology, you know, communism, Bolshevism, Marxism, frequently peddled by eternal enemies, and created with the design and the intent, as you said, to basically undermine European society, the family, bourgeois society, you know, decency and standards, all in the name of liberation from some nebulous oppressor. And so I think, I'm not sure why Gottfried wrote his article, but I think that some of the reaction to it, why it was so fevered, was because perhaps Gottfried is implying that actually, you know, liberalism has some culpability here, has to bear some blame. And the more I think about it, I think that actually Marxism today, to the extent that, you know, we can call it Marxism, it kind of coexists with liberalism. It kind of dovetails with liberalism. It exists almost like in a symbiotic, parasitic relationship with liberalism. And I can understand why someone looking at, again, being very specific with terms, pure Marxism does not have much to do with queer theory. It doesn't have much to do with, you know, putting trannies on the face of beer cans. And yet, liberalism, the pursuit of individual liberties, equality for all, you know, that it, when it's twisted and perverted or taken to its most extreme form, that in fact does allow for a lot of this decay and degeneracy and dysfunction that we're seeing. But that kind of upsets people who don't want to look at a Northwestern European model of organizing society as having such massive problem inherent in it. I don't know what you think about that.
Well, I do think that he's trying to throw a lot of the blame on liberalism here. Liberalism has its problems. We can talk about that. I can talk till I'm blue in the face about the problems of liberalism. But in this case, I think there is a kind of scapegoating going on. Let me read a couple paragraphs here. I think I can zero in on this. So he says, the woke left is an even more grotesque distortion of Marxism than anything the interwar and post-war Frankfurt School brought forth. This left has shed any recognizable Marxist theory, but it continues to venerate communist heroes while appealing to the interwar struggle between the communist left and fascism. Despite socialist proposals that occasionally enter woke wish lists, corporate capitalists are integral to the post-Marxist left. Nor are such capitalists likely to suffer any ill effects, even if the green agenda that most Western countries are pushing is put more broadly into effect. And then he goes on, and he talks about corporate capitalists, and then we get into the attack on liberalism. And let's talk first about capitalism here and then liberalism, because they're related, obviously. But there is this meme, and people in our sphere have been pushing this meme, that no, wokeism is a product of capitalism. It's a late-stage capitalist epiphenomenon or something like that. They actually try and use Marxist language to describe wokeism as an ideological fixture of capitalism. I don't know why some people are so hypnotized by Marxist duck speak and are trying to defend the honor of Marx. And I don't think you can pin wokeism on capitalists. There are two points that need to be made here. One, historically, Marxists, communists, have been very cozy with certain kinds of capitalists, and they wouldn't have ever gotten where they were without the cooperation of international bankers and merchants of various sorts. And that is just a historical fact. So there's always been a cozy relationship between communists and capitalists of a certain stripe. Now, beyond that, though, talking about how today's big corporations are parroting woke slogans and stuff like that, and then trying to say, well, this is because it's their project, I just think that's false. The reason why most corporations are woke is the same reason that most corporations were patriotic 50 years ago and Christian 100 years ago. They are simply money-making enterprises that are not pushing an ideological agenda, but they are conforming to the dominant ideology of the time. That's the primary reason why these companies put little green trees on their cups and Black Lives Matter flags and put up rainbow flags in their windows and things like that. They are conforming to an oppressive, omnipresent moral paradigm that's been imposed upon society and hasn't been imposed upon society by capitalists. Where does it come from? It comes from academia, the media, and not just media qua business, but the people who shape ideas, intellectuals, leftist intellectuals in the universities and in other institutions have imposed this moral paradigm on society, and businesses are conforming to it. That's primarily why you have woke corporations today. There's conformism to established moral paradigms that they did not create and they're not driving forward. So I just think it's a red herring that ignores the causal issue here. Who's pushing this? It's an ideological phenomenon. It's not being pushed by capitalists. It's being pushed on capitalists and everybody else, largely by intellectuals. So that's one thing I think is important to get out there. I don't think that we can voice this on capitalism. Now, there are certain individual capitalists who are not just conforming, but pushing this forward, just like there were individual capitalists who were pushing communism 100 years ago. But I think by and large, the relationship of these ideas to capitalism is that these ideas are coming into the marketplace, into the culture, and capitalists are conforming to them. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty fair assessment. I was just thinking again about the leaked video of the female vice president of Bud Light. Why did they want to use Dylan Mulvaney as the face of their drink? Well, because they need to reach out to a younger consumer demographic, which I guess, you know, yeah, get the kids drinking Bud Light while they're get the tranny loving kids to start drinking alcohol, I guess, as young as you can. It's kind of a funny thing to admit. And, you know, change the image from being associated with frat parties to...
And rednecks, who are the people who drink 90% of that swill anyway. Exactly. Maybe 99% of that swill.
And so why is she doing that? Of course, it's because it's not that Anheuser-Busch is creating this moment in culture. No, this is clearly a, I believe, Jewish vice president wanting to do something eye-catching and do something transgressive, but also, you know, rolling the dice, you know, see how this goes and get some headlines and then adapt to the zeitgeist that's already been created by the academy, the media, and pop culture. So yeah, I think you're right about that. I guess with tracing this genealogy of where we're at now and everything's going on, because of it doesn't make sense. There's so many contradictions. Why are Antifa, who consider themselves anarchists, beating up people in the streets in the name of upholding the status quo and the regime? Why do they feel like they are the oppressed, you know, minority, the marginalized, powerless minority, when every single institution, corporation, celebrity, you know, is all on their side? How does that work? It's a contradiction. It doesn't make any sense. And in this tracing of the genealogy, tracing of how we got to this point, there is a lot of confusion, because even in Gottfried's piece, he writes that the Frankfurt School distorted Marxism. So already we have one distortion. I think it's fair to trace a lot of this to the Frankfurt School. A lot of their ideas are clearly playing out right now, and they have been for decades. And the Frankfurt School members were Marxists, but they had to tweak it. They had to tweak Marxism. So already there's been one distortion, because Marx himself, again, the title of the piece, Marx was not woke. I think that's fair enough. But what was he concerned with then? He was mostly concerned with class struggle. And this is another thing that causes a contradiction in terms, I suppose, is that, you know, perhaps it still exists in a sense in Britain and in some parts of Europe maybe, but for the most part in the West, we don't really have class struggle anymore. And this is why people argue that it had to be, Marxism had to be tweaked into cultural Marxism, because the class struggle just kind of dissipated. You know, in Gottfried's piece, he's writing about the working class and the middle class. And I've often thought this for some time, and I don't use these terms very much, because we don't have, you know, landed gentry anymore. We don't have nobility. Again, in the case of Britain, you could argue that it still kind of exists, but not in as intense a manner as it did for most of British history. You know, we're all working. The most wealthy, the wealthiest, most powerful people, they're not nobles. They're not titled people. They're entrepreneurs, they're hedge fund managers. And so the whole idea of economic class struggle, or, you know, proletariat versus bourgeois versus, you know, titled landed gentry types, well, that had to be tweaked as well once that no longer was the reality of Western societies for the most part. So, yeah, I think there's been a lot of distortions. And I could see why people would say, no, we've got to go back to Marxism, certainly to the Frankfurt School, that first distortion, that first adaptation of Marxism. Okay, fair enough. But I, like I said earlier, I think that there's this symbiotic relationship that you know, this distorted form of Marxism enjoys thanks to modern Western liberalism. It exists because of it. It's allowed to thrive outside of power because of it. And then, of course, once the Marxists get power, then we see what they do.
Mm-hmm. Well, first, the great distortion, right, that Frankfurt thinkers brought into Marxism was basically waking up and smelling the coffee and realizing that the proletariat was not going to be the vanguard of communism. Marx was just wrong about that, right? Marx is completely wrong about that. In the 20th century, the working classes were more nationalist than internationalist. They started noticing that during the First World War. After the First World War, what did you have? You had fascism arising in Italy. You had National Socialism in Germany. You had equivalent movements arising in places like Hungary and Romania. And in France, too. The Frankfurt School simply recognized that the working class was not going to bring about the overthrow of capitalism and that it was going to be something else. And so they started looking for new constituencies. And really, at a certain point, they just sort of gave up on at least talking about overthrowing capitalism. What their discourse became about, and this was quite clear in the 1960s, was simply sort of a pervasive critique of capitalism, cultural critique of capitalism, and a demand, which they forwarded by actual political organizing, a demand for inclusion and upward mobility of previously marginalized groups. Now, because the Frankfurt School was almost entirely Jewish, I look at these groups as just proxies for Jews. The Jewish will to power that was being expressed by Marx and classical Marxist-Leninism, thinking that they're going to ride to power on the working class, that didn't even really work in the USSR, right? That idea was abandoned. And a new vehicles for this kind of will to power were invented by the Frankfurt School. And so they pursued cultural hegemony through cultural critique and through the infiltration of organizations within capitalism that shaped the economy, that shaped the ideological sphere, that shaped the culture, right? That's the direction they went. This is why it's completely reasonable to call this cultural Marxism. They did the long march through the institutions to change the cultures. Now, of course, that's a huge heresy from a Marxist point of view, orthodox Marxism, because it's basically just throwing out the idea that the ideological superstructure always lags behind and is determined by the economic political base. But that was a perfectly legitimate thing to dispense with as well, because it's blatantly false. And so the distortions of Marx, I think, that you can pin on the Frankfurt School are really corrections of Marx's failings and a course change by a group of people who were drawn to Marxism and looked at it as a vehicle for their collective will to power, largely Jews. And so the new form of Marxism that we have today is, I think, more based in reality, which is why it's been so incredibly successful. They understand it's the based power in of also ideas.
Psychology as well. That one thing that the Frankfurt School did was incorporate a lot of Freudian theory and, you know, how they, again, another Jew. So it's a very in-group development of ideas there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think it's true that the Frankfurt School had to update Marxism because it did fail to live up to its predictions. I would say that that's a fair assessment.
Yeah, and so how much do you have to blame liberalism and capitalism for this? Well, you can certainly blame liberalism and capitalism for not repulsing this. However, just pure liberalism and sort of pure capitalism isn't capable of repulsing this. Because one of the things that's going on here is you've got collectivist groups networked together, working as collectives to gain power over people who play by individualist rules. That's the way that capitalism works. That's the way that liberalism works. These are individualist strategies, basically, for creating a society. And when they are allowed to just function with people who play by those rules, they become enormously prosperous and powerful. Great places to live. However, they don't have any way to protect themselves from collectivist parasitic tribes that insert themselves into this and start doing double dealing, where they demand that you always give them a fair break because you've got to play by individualist rules. But because they're collectivists, they always give their own tribe a fair break. And well, basic game theory predicts that as long as you allow these parasite groups to continue playing you, you are going to lose more and more power, wealth, and social control to these groups. And that's exactly what we've got happening. And so my view is that liberalism is primarily a problem, and capitalism is primarily problematic, not because they embrace and support these deeply collectivist cheats, which is what's going on here, because in their heart of hearts, they reject that. It's because they're too weak and blind to repel that. Because if they were to see through this, then they would have to constitute themselves as a collective of their own. We, the individualists, now have to band together and vote these parasite tribal groups off our island. And suddenly, individualism is gone. And what you've got is group strategies in both camps battling it out.
Yeah, that's what I was alluding to earlier. It seems to me that liberalism kind of acts as a vector, or it's like a pond, stagnant pond, where these parasitic Marxists can thrive. And so it's sort of like Marxism, cultural Marxism, depends on liberalism to exist. And I guess this is also why it's important to be very clear about what we're talking about, because if we're specifically talking about something like Black Lives Matter, for example, I would say that it's probably a lot more fair and reasonable to use the term Marxist to describe something like BLM, both in its nature, its behavior, and its origins and desires. But that's not all that woke is about. Woke is BLM, but other things as well. And I think the sexual liberation type thing, we just want to get married, now we want to have kids, now bake the cake, now prune your kids, and then we'll see what other letters get added to the, you know, the alphabet people. I think that could be more a fault of liberalism, because it is about personal liberty. It is about just let the individual do whatever he wants, you know, as long as you're not harming anybody. And then, of course, equality, which is another fundamental principle of liberalism.
Right. But here's the thing. That's what liberal suckers say when they're being played. It's like, well, you know, why not be, I mean, well, aren't we about openness and tolerance and individual self-expression, et cetera? And so they basically allow this, but they don't recognize that what they're doing is they're giving a leg up to, again, a networked parasitic group that's playing them, because they're playing for keeps. They don't want to coexist, right? That's one of the things that liberals want to do. It's like, well, why can't we all coexist? Bumper sticker, right? They don't want to coexist. They want to assimilate and dominate. And you allow these people to gain power in your society because you just want to coexist. Well, here's the thing. You can't coexist with people who don't want to coexist with you. And if you come to that realization, then you start scanning these people and thinking, these people have to be excluded. We have to vote these people out of our individualist society. And it's, again, no longer an individualist game. It's groups competing with collective strategies. And so this is why they're so resistant to this, because they have to give up their basic fundamental assumptions in the face of competing groups. And they can't do that.
And Gottfried mentioned this in the article, especially in, as it relates to academia, all of the liberal professors who are now shocked and appalled at the woke left and its repression of free speech, its repression of the sharing of ideas. Although Gottfried mentions that those liberal professors were kind of doing that themselves anyway, just excluding conservatives, basically.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, they've been completely outflanked. And that's, I guess, evidence of how these aren't, you know, you can't just say it's 100% all Marxism or no, it's the fault of liberalism. There's a bit of nuance to go around here.
Yeah.
But it's certainly evidence of them being competing ideologies that, you know, one exists thanks to the other. But when the rubber meets the road, the collectivist Marxist, you know, Frankfurt School types completely dominate the liberals and then end up excluding them. And we've seen that all over the academy to the point now where we've got the phenomenon, right, of the classical liberals trying to defend what you used to have, what, you know, upheld as the classical liberal ideal of free expression, because they've been completely dominated by this more radical group, which I think, you could say with reason, gets their inspiration from certainly Frankfurt School adaptations of Marxism.
There's an essay by Marcuse called Repressive Tolerance. Tolerance is repressive of us, and our repression of them is progressive. It sounds like doublespeak, but it's really not. This is very consistent ideology of gaining power over people and just rejecting liberalism. They reject liberalism entirely. So in the last few paragraphs, he talks about liberalism. I'll start three paragraphs from the end. Hazzoni's observation is accurate, but it may require clarification. The liberalism that the woke left canceled was a greatly weakened form of the liberal persuasion, the exponents of which had already ceased to argue very convincingly for open discussion. This is true, but you can say that what they were is they were increasingly shrill, dogmatic left liberals, and they were being illiberal themselves. For decades, that attenuated liberalism excluded the right, except for a moderate centrist version of it that could not upset leftist gatekeepers. Absolutely. The illiberal liberals is what we're talking about here. It's a betrayal of liberalism. The parameters of allowable discussion on many issues have become more and more restricted before a late form of liberalism gave up the ghost entirely. Well, if it's given up the ghost on that, then you can't say that's liberalism. It's wearing the skin of liberalism, but there's something underneath it that's a different kind of organism entirely. By then, the universities were already being ideologically controlled, while both government and the media had prepared the way for this post-liberal age. And then I'll skip forward to the last paragraph. And I think there's something golden in here. This observation is not meant to invalidate Hazzoni's larger point, which is correct. At some point in the last 20 years, the very ideal of open discussion and debate fell into disrepute, both in institutions of higher learning and in the media. What had become a shrunken, denatured liberalism was abandoned for a successor ideology, wokeism. In some ways, I would just say that they shrugged off the skin of liberalism and they're just openly illiberal at this point, because it's a lot of the same people who've undergone this change, or what the older generation, the denatured liberals, are really leftists, and they're the teachers of the younger generation that's just basically shrugged off all pretenses of openness. Well, why would they not do that? They feel fully in charge now. Leftists appeal to liberalism. The ACLU, right, was put together to appeal to liberalism in order to empower the left. The left is now in power, and so they don't need that anymore. They can kick away the ladder that they climbed up. Further, there may be no way back to what has been resoundingly repudiated and what took generations to collapse, namely liberalism. Only an equally determined collectivism can effectively resist those who have ended the liberal era or what became the pale imitation of one. That's a golden line. Only an equally determined collectivism can effectively resist those who have ended the liberal era or what became a pale imitation of one. What is that collectivism? Well, Hazzoni wants to helpfully come in and argue that it's a kind of conservative nationalism, Judeo-Christian, of course, very Judeo. It's his national conservatism project, right? That's as collectivist as we will be allowed. He's a very much a gatekeeper. He did have the decency to write to me and tell me that I couldn't attend his first national conservatism conference. He just can't help himself. He immediately fell into the gatekeeping thing. The National Conservatism OP is sponsored by something called the Edmund Burke Institute. The Edmund Burke Institute is run out of Jerusalem with the same staff as the Theodore Herzl Institute. So to say that this is a Zionist op, it's not hyperbole. It literally is an operation of a Zionist enterprise based in Jerusalem, named after the founder of Zionism, Theodore Herzl. Which is not to say that national conservatism isn't an improvement over the absolute swill that came before it. But still, it's a Zionist op, and it's so obvious that what this is an attempt to do is get out ahead of national populism and neuter it so that it's still comfortable and safe and becomes a sort of Jewish-approved possibility within the political spectrum.
Yeah. What's funny was, as I was listening to you read those paragraphs, another thought that came to me, I don't know if you caught the marathon conversation I had with Millennial Woes a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking about how one thing that distinguishes this era that we're in is just how all-consuming, omnipotent, omnipresent is the rainbow regime. And I think that that is also something else to distinguish between, you know liberalism. How much blame does, you know, classical liberalism have to bear here? And certainly when you think about how aggressive and its enormous appetite for power, and it's all consuming, and it's something that, you know, Woes and I were talking about, and he had observed that, you know, in 2015, 2016, all the refugees welcome rallies, all the people who welcomed refugees at German train stations, there was no rainbow flag, and there certainly wasn't the rainbow flag with the brown and black stripes for Black Lives and the pastel colored blue and pink for the troons now. None of that was present, but now it's everywhere. Now these things have all syncretized, and it's all just one massive, all-consuming ideology. And I think it's fair to say that that's not, you know, liberalism, and as Gottfried writes in his piece there, it's sort of weak, neutered liberalism that has long given up the ghost. And that's why it was so easy to replace it with this very aggressive thing.
It's an aggressive and totalitarian ideology, yes, spawned from Marxism. Mm-hmm. And these people who run BLM, they claim that they're Marxists.
They are, exactly. BLM is definitely Marxist. I would agree with that.
Antifa is definitely anti-fascist. It's it's definitely inspired by Marxism or anarchism. It's definitely, whatever it's inspired. Anarchism is anarchism will never exist in the world. So somebody who claims to be an anarchist is basically just a tool of somebody else, in my opinion. Yeah, so these people look to Marxism and Marxist figures for inspiration. They're most formed by the cultural brand of Marxism, the Frankfurt School, which jettisoned a lot of things about classical Marxism that were just false. And to say that they're not Marxists because they're not cultural materialists or they hate working class white people, I just think is sort of short-sighted. It's like saying that, again, it's like saying that Brooks Adams was not descended from John Adams because Brooks Adams didn't wear a powdered wig. It's like, we know there are differences, you know, there are differences from generation to generation. And if you just want to perversely focus on inessential differences, you can do that, but you're just, you know, you're just kicking up dust and throwing it in people's eyes. And I don't know what the purpose of that is. There is a tendency for people on the right to want to defend the honor of Marxism now and to attack liberalism, attack capitalism for wokeness. I don't know what's going on there.
Part of National Socialists, if you want to use that term, have always, since the inception of National Socialism, have always had to deal with this two-headed beast. On the one hand, you have Marxism, Bolshevism, and on the other hand, you have capitalism and materialism of the Anglo-American sphere. And so I suppose it just comes down to what head on that beast certain, you know, group or individual is targeting. And it seems to be that there is this divide, and it seems difficult to bridge this divide. Again, we talked about this last month. You know, some people are writing apologia for Marxism or trying to give big brain deep dive takes on it, and other people just recoil at the very word.
They just think that Reds need bullets, and and they don't want to hear these big brained takes on that.
And then I think there is also, with reason, there's good reason to have these trepidations and these concerns. And I think that the other side has some concerns that there is actually some good in liberalism. It comes from European minds, comes from the European spirit. So it works for us. It's not some foreign ideology or subversive system imposed upon us or working against us. And, you know, in times of tyranny or totalitarianism, the tools for our salvation would be found in liberalism. And then, of course, there's all sorts of, you know, positive arguments for the benefits of capitalism. And people are loath to, especially people on you know, the normie conservative side, are really loath to admit that there might be significant shortcomings in capitalism. And I think that, you know, I don't know where Paul Gottfried, you know, comes down on all of this. It's not someone that I've read a lot of, but I can see why his article here kind of provoked again another spate of of, you know, reactions. But yeah, ultimately, I suppose that he was just trying to argue that Marx himself wouldn't be a pink and blue haired, you know, I think he's trying to say that he would have been a classical liberal or something, or he wouldn't have been supporting the types like Dylan Mulvaney and suggesting that children should be put on chemical castration medication or puberty blockers. You know, that's all well beyond anything that Marx ever concerned himself with. And to that extent, I suppose that's true. But to say then that, so it's okay, I suppose, to say that Marx himself was not woke. If we, by woke, you mean virulently anti-white, using any means possible, including, you know, trans and even now even basically pedophilia, to use that to form this bludgeon, this totalitarian bludgeon in European societies, Western societies. Marx was primarily concerned with economic theory and things like that. And also he lived in the 1860s. Okay, fair enough. But wokeism can certainly be traced to some of his ideas, and certainly the ideas that went through the changes of the Marxist Frankfurt School. But yeah, I find these things, you know, these diagnostic takes, they can be interesting sometimes, but other times I wonder what is the purpose of them as well. I am kind of curious. And I mean, how far back do you want to go?
Right.
This is also something that comes up often when people are trying to say, you know, is America to blame? Is America the great vector of all of this wokeism stuff? Or was it in fact the British and the British Empire? Or was it Hungarian Jews? you know,
the Germans.
Was it the Germans? Exactly. And if you want to go back, you know, if you want to play that game, I would argue you could trace some of the seeds of this, you know, current zeitgeist and the problems that it entails. You could trace them to Christianity. You could trace them to the Roman Empire. Like, how far back do you want to go? And I think that just comes inherent with being a salon culture of intellectuals who like to diagnose problems, really.
And it's an honorable profession. And we're doing what the left did to take power. We're engaged in metapolitics and cultural critique and culture construction of our own. And a little bit of bare knuckles, dust ups, debate, and a little bit of blood sports really isn't such a bad thing along the way. It keeps people engaged as long as people don't completely fall out and hate one another over it and lose track of what they have in common. So I think this has been a productive discussion. I see that there are problems with what Gottfried is doing. However, I do think that we have to recognize that any genealogical argument always is going to recognize that there are differences between one generation and another generation of a particular intellectual tradition. And therefore, to point out differences in and of themselves is not a refutation of these kinds of genealogies. The issue is, what's essential? Are there certain essential ideas that have carried on from Marx to the Frankfurt School to the wokists? And I do think Hazzoni's right. He zeroes in on the class struggle thing, on the collectivism, the anti-individualism, the quest for power that Marxism injects into politics. And that is a carryover. And they have changed a lot of their foundational views. A lot of things have been discarded because they were simply turned out to be false. They were in the business of historical predictions, and a lot of the predictions were wrong. So I do think that this is a good discussion to have, though. Do you want to round this off, Pox? Are there any final thoughts on this? Then we can do an AMA, because we've got a bunch of questions now.
Well, I would just say, sort of finalize it, I thought it was an interesting article by Gottfried. I didn't quite see the reason it upset people so much. But again, like I said on the stream with Morgoth, I don't get too invested in the whole, you know, recoiling at the word socialism or getting my hackles up if anyone criticizes capitalism. I'm not too invested in economic systems or anything like that. But yeah, as I was reading it, I wondered what was the purpose of it. I suppose it's a book review of Hazzoni's book. But it's worth thinking about these things, because I do think that some of what we are dealing with is not just the fault of Karl Marx and Marxist ideology. I do think that a lot of it can be traced to the Frankfurt School. But then I also think that, you know, whiling away the time with diagnostic endeavors, I'm more interested in dealing with the present and finding ways to resist what these people are doing, overcome what they're doing, and put them on the back foot if I can. Mm-hmm. So that would
be... Yeah, I do think, though, that having a proper diagnosis, you know, is it capitalism that's pushing this, or is this coming from intellectuals, academia, the culture industry, stuff like that? I do think that those are important issues to hash out.
Oh, sure. They can definitely give you good standing. I think if it wasn't for all the diagnostic work we do, someone like myself, for example, might still be floundering in, well, where exactly am I supposed to position myself on this battlefield? Mm-hmm. And also, who am I fighting against? That's what I think is my primary focus whenever I'm trying to red pill someone, or, you know, keeping my eye on the prize, is like, who are we fighting? Who's responsible? You can get into a lot of trouble for identifying who are you fighting.
Yeah.
But I think that is the purpose served by these diagnostic efforts, for sure.
Absolutely. I do think that also pulling back and seeing these sorts of debates between Gottfried and Hazzoni and between Marx and the Frankfurt School and the wokists within the broad context that Kevin MacDonald gives us, talking about Jewish intellectual movements, I think that that brings everything into a greater degree of clarity as well. So folks, if you would like to ask Pox and me some questions, go to entropystream.live/countercurrents, hit the green button, pull out your credit card, and send us a super chat. We very much appreciate it. It helps us keep the lights on. It helps us do what we do. And we are very, very grateful for it. We're grateful for Entropy because they're one of the few ways that we can take money through credit cards. We have been deplatformed from the global credit card processing industry. They stood by us the whole time because they believe in freedom of speech. And I very much appreciate that as well. So if you would like to leave a question with a super chat, that is the best way to do it. Go to Entropy. You can also send us questions in the chat at DLive, even send us a token or two, as well as over at Odyssey. So you can also email me. You can send things to me through Telegram as well. So let's quickly go and check Entropy, see if we got some questions and comments and donations here.